This is a production of Cornell University.
I'm Cecilia de Longzin, an undergraduate in the School of Arts and Science and president of the Cornell French Society. It's great to see you all here for our inaugural event. We founded the society at the beginning of the semester, and we have two goals in mind. Basically, we want to promote the French culture on the Cornell campus and, in a way, foster the intellectual vibrancy of it. And we also want to not only act as a catalyzer for those events just by saying, oh, this is happening right now, but we also want to create a community of people who come together and who share a common interest in French culture and its relevance to the world and whatnot. So it's in the society mindset that I warmly invite you to attend the reception that's going to follow this talk that's happening in the adjoining room. You can all get to meet each other. The event tonight is it's interdisciplinary because it draws from topics of philosophy, history, government, politics, and it develops parallels and distinctions between France and the US, which is, I think, very important. So for us, we could wonder what's the relevance of Sartre today, because he's an old philosopher, he lived in the second part of the 20th century, and we're in a context of financial crisis and crisis of confidence with wars in Afghanistan, wars in Iraq, war on terror, whatnot. So how is it relevant to the elections or to study and talk about him? What can he teach us today? And it's an honor to have Annie Cancelal here to answer these questions. Annie Cancelal was born in Algeria and studied at the Sorbonne in Paris. She taught in Paris, Caen, Berlin, and even Jerusalem. And in 1985, she wrote a book called Sartre, A Life, which was a true success and was translated in over 16 languages. And it's the most complete and official biography of Sartre today. So from 89 to 93, she served as the cultural counselor to the French embassy in the United States. And drawing from this experience, she wrote a book called Painting American, The Rise of American Artists, Paris, 1867 to New York, 1948, which is one of my favorite books, and who basically explains the shift in the cultural capital from Paris to New York. So her latest book is on Leo Castellia, gallerist, American gallerist, and it's going to be published in 2009. And she's now a professor in the Tisch School at New York University. She's going to talk for about an hour on the topic of Sartre, the question of terror, and the US presidential election. So please join me in welcoming Annie Cancelal.
Thank you, Cecilia. So I came to Cornell a few times already in different roles as a cultural counselor, as a writer, as a lot of things. But it's the first time that I'm invited by this French society, you call it? And it couldn't be more appealing to me. I mean, Cecilia called me, Louis too, I want to include him. Cecilia and Louis are friends of my son, so it's, and I knew them when they were little children, and there's no way I would have refused this invitation. It was not easy for me, because I was yesterday in Chicago, I flew back to New York late last night, and I took the bus here, but there was no way I would miss this appointment, because it is a great honor for me to respond to a call from students. I think it's the most important is when there is a need from students to learn and to hear and to debate, then I am always there. When it comes from my colleagues, not so much, but from students always, especially from people like you. So now, Cornell is a campus where a lot is happening. You know, I have been around, like, even last week, I was in, like, 10 different colleges. But One thing which is specific at Cornell is that, and which I had no idea before coming to the United States, is this campus has, first of all, a French tradition. And I was interested in discussing with Dominique Lacapra, Steve Kaplan. I came also here with Jacques Derrida, that came here very often, and who happened to be my cousin. I came also to see the museum with this extraordinary collection. And Cornell has also a history with Jean-Paul Sartre. And that's one of the reasons that the title is not exactly what I'm going to talk about, but you're going to forgive me and you can ask me all kinds of questions in the end. Basically, what I want to do is have a debate with you. That's why I'm here. Why is Sartre linked to Cornell? Because Sartre's relationship with the United States, which I'm going to start talking in a minute about, is extremely interesting, extremely complex, and not at all what people think it is. But Sartre came to the US twice. It is a country he knew the best, the country he understood the best, and the third trip was supposed to be at Cornell in 1965, Cornell University. He never came, but he wrote the conference nevertheless, which is called the Cornell Conference, which is an extremely interesting conference, and which is still located somewhere in the campus, and which is the topic of a lot of investigations from Sartre scholars, especially philosophers, and politologists. And it has also to do with the American presidential campaign. So when I was coming here on the bus, I was asking myself, yeah, exactly the question Cecilia was asking. What is the relevance of Sartre today? And she, of this old philosopher, you said, Sartre is not an old philosopher, he's a dead philosopher. Okay, but I think he's a dead philosopher, but he's a very relevant philosopher. Okay, so for me, he's a young philosopher, a dead young philosopher, who is really addressing people like you, people in search. Sartre has always been someone who was searching, who was looking for the truth, who was trying to hug the truth, wherever it was. Somebody who didn't mind contradicting himself, as somebody who expressed his own points of views according to the different context where it was where he was involved. So let me just, before wrapping it up my introduction, also talk a little bit about why a French club in a college or in a university today, and then we'll switch to this young dead philosopher. So what is why is it so that it is so important? Why is it so important to open our eyes to foreign cultures, to other cultures? Last week, a guy came to tutor my son. He came from Princeton Review. He was 27 years old. He went to Wesleyan. He's now doing a PhD at Penn. So he's got an excellent American education. And when he went out, he said to me, what did you write about? And I said, Sartre. And he said, Sartre. I mean, Sartre. I said, yeah, Sartre. I mean, Sartre. I mean, anyway, the guy had never heard the name of Sartre. So, I mean, it happened to me that if people didn't know whether he was a, you know, I don't know. But anyway, that absence of knowledge, I mean, I was pretty shocked. So I'd like to check who, I mean, I hope you know who Sartre was, right? So basically, that is an interesting element because somebody can go through a good American education through Ivy League colleges not having heard at all the name of Sartre. So who is there to blame? You know, is it the American education? Is it the French system? What is it? Why is my position is that you don't have to learn to go through French language or French literature to hear the name Sartre. It's not a question of going through you know, another language, but it's also general knowledge. I mean, Sartre was the philosopher of the 20th century. He was born in 1905, died in 1980. He was the most prolific writer of the century, and he is someone that could be compared in his importance in civil society as Voltaire in the 18th century, Zola in the 19th century, because he is a man who worked with his own tools, which were a pen and paper, like very, very simple tools. But with those tools, he raised to the status of universal consciousness and addressed issues such as the issue of authority, and started to demand answers from heads of states and from most powerful countries in the world on behalf of the civil society. So what is interesting here is that the role of the French philosopher, as it was born in the 18th century, the 19th century, the 20th century, is the studies of an intellectual who is also caring about the issues of his own society. You will hear Sartre today talk, and I really want you to get a feeling of his voice, of his presence, of his charisma. He's going to say something like, un intellectuel, c'est quelqu'un qui s'intéresse toujours à ce qui ne le regarde pas. An intellectual is someone who's caring about things which are not directly... I'm sorry?
Are not of his business.
Exactly, are not, exactly, are not of his business, exactly. So basically what he's saying is that you have to be involved. You have to be committed. You have to put your nose everywhere where it's forbidden. You have to address taboos. You have to look under the rug. You have to address those very issues that people want to keep behind the veil. That's what a responsible citizen is about. Mm-hmm. So I think that Cecilia, so we had discussed many times the different options, you know, talking about art, talking about, but I think that it couldn't be a better idea than talk about Sartre today and to launch your French society. I can come again if you want. Not by the bus, and not by the same bus, but another time, if you like it. So that's why I think that there is something a little worrying here for me, that someone who's 27 years old out of an Ivy League college or university has never heard the name of Sartre. Because Sartre should not be known by people who are reading, you know, Nausea or see the his play Huis Clos, No Exit, whatever, or read Les Chemins de la Liberté, his novels and so on, or read his articles of journalism and so on. But people who have simply learned history of the 20th century and people who have learned about the movements of decolonization, Sartre was absolutely crucial to what happened in Algeria, for example, in Korea, in Vietnam. Sartre addressed those issues. He and just for that, it's a scandal that his name has been erased from American higher education. Now, the best thing we should do, I think I'm going to turn him on. Are we going to invite this young dead philosopher with us today? And I
Et pour répondre, c'est votre réponse. Tout un homme fait de tous les autres et qu'il est vaut tous et que vaut n'importe qui. Aussitôt après la parution des mots, on vous a décerné le prix Nobel de littérature. Vous l'avez refusé et ceci a fait dire à quelqu'un qui vous aimait bien, et je trouve ça extrêmement drôle et j'aimerais que vous parliez là-dessus, décidément Sartre est plus n'importe qui que n'importe qui.
Eh bien, vous voyez, quand je dis tout un homme fait de tous les hommes, ça vaut pour moi comme pour tous, et ça signifie par conséquent une telle communauté en profondeur entre les gens que vraiment ce qui les sépare c'est du différentiel. Autrement dit, je trouve que il vaut mieux essayer de réaliser en soi, dans son aspect radical, la condition humaine, autant qu'on le peut, que de s'accrocher à une mince différence spécifique, que nous appellerons par exemple le talent, qui est un crime contre soi-même et contre les autres, parce que c'est s'attacher uniquement à ce qui sépare. En vérité, quand je dis que je suis n'importe qui, je veux dire les différences qui font l'objet de vanité, de recherche et d'ambition sont si minces qu'il faut vraiment être très modeste pour les rechercher. Et en même temps, on se l'utile. Ce que je trouve, au contraire, que je ne puis réaliser moi-même, parce que je suis, c'est ma contradiction bourgeois, c'est certains rapports extrêmes avec la mort, le besoin, l'amour, la famille, dans un même moment de danger, qui fait que, à ce moment-là, on touche à la vraie réalité humaine, c'est-à-dire à l'ensemble des rapports vécus à tous les termes limites de notre condition. Ça, pour moi, c'est pour ça que j'ai du respect pour les gens qui vivent dans ce domaine, par exemple, si vous voulez, pour ce qu'étaient des paysans cubains avant la Révolution. Dans la misère, dans la souffrance, à mon avis, ils réalisaient infiniment mieux ce que c'est qu'un homme, que M. de Monterland, par exemple. Et c'est ça que je veux dire. Cependant, je pense que dans ces conditions, être n'importe qui n'est pas simplement une réalité, c'est aussi une tâche. C'est-à-dire refuser tous les traits distinctifs pour pouvoir parler au nom de tout le monde. Et on ne peut parler au nom de tout le monde que si on est tout le monde. Pas chercher à la manière de tant de pauvres de mes confrères le surhomme, mais au contraire, être le plus homme possible, c'est-à-dire le plus semblable aux autres. Donc il s'agit en effet d'une tâche. Autrement dit, je suis complètement d'accord avec un des idéaux de Marx qui veut que lorsque un bouleversement de la société aura supprimé la division du travail, il n'y aura plus d'écrivains d'un côté, attachés à leur petite particularité d'écrivain, à leur petit talent d'écrivain, et puis de l'autre, des mineurs ou des ingénieurs, mais qu'il y aura des hommes qui écrivent, et qui par ailleurs font autre chose, mais qui écrivent en ce moment. Parce que l'activité d'écrire est une activité absolument liée à la condition humaine, c'est l'usage du langage pour fixer la vie, c'est donc une chose essentielle. Mais elle ne doit précisément pas pour ça être confiée à des spécialistes. Elle est actuellement confiée à des spécialistes en fonction de la division du travail, mais dans la réalité, il faudrait concevoir des hommes qui seraient polyvalents. Je ne sais pas si c'est réalisable. Ça, c'est un autre problème. Je sais qu'en tout cas, nous devons essayer, chacun individuellement, les écrivains, par exemple, de penser des choses comme ça.
Et le prix Nobel de littérature aurait été une distinction.
Le prix Nobel de littérature aurait été précisément une petite distinction, un petit pouvoir, une séparation. Moi, je n'ai de rapport qu'avec mon public.
Mais est-ce que vous auriez accepté, Sartre, le prix Nobel de la paix ?
Non, pas plus que le prix Nobel de littérature. Ce que j'aurais accepté avec reconnaissance, c'est le prix Nobel au moment des 121. Parce qu'à ce moment-là, je ne l'aurais pas considéré comme me distinguant, mais comme une preuve de solidarité dans des pays étrangers touchant une action radicale contre la guerre. À ce moment-là, oui. Mais je ne l'aurais pas considéré comme étant à moi.
Comme un acte politique.
Comme un acte politique.
Et Nobel de littérature ou Nobel de la paix ?
Peu importe à ce moment-là. Ça aurait été quand même... bon.
C'est ça, ben, ça aurait d'ailleurs résolu la...
Contradiction.
La contradiction, absolument. Mais précisément pour ça, on ne l'a pas donné à ce moment-là, mais cette contradiction n'est pas possible à résoudre. Je vous dirais que l'intellectuel est ainsi fait qu'il se mêle toujours de ce qui nous regarde. Si je suis le dernier penseur du 20e siècle, aujourd'hui, je suis aussi le dernier penseur du 20e, parce que je ne vois pas que les autres puissent être considérés comme des penseurs. Ce sont ou bien des rhétoriciens, simplement des rhéteurs, ou bien des sophistes. Il faut voir qu'un politique et un intellectuel sont deux choses complètement différentes. Ce n'est pas agréable d'être intellectuel. Je vous dirais que l'intellectuel est ainsi fait qu'il se mêle toujours de ce qui nous regarde. Si je suis le dernier penseur du 19e siècle, aujourd'hui, je suis aussi le dernier penseur du 20e, parce que je ne vois pas que les autres puissent être considérés comme des penseurs. Ce sont ou bien des rhétoriciens, simplement des rhéteurs, ou bien des sophistes.
All right, so that was in French, and I fear that a few people didn't get the whole... were the problems? Some people don't speak French, right?
No,
you can... You can hear, okay. So, but I will make a kind of a summary of the whole thing. First of all, the context of this interview. This interview was conducted for the Canadian television in 1967, just during the Vietnam War. And the first question, it was conducted by someone you might have recognized. The man is Claude Lanzmann, the man who did the film Shoah, right? And next to him was a Canadian journalist, Madeleine Gobeil. The first question they ask him has to do with the last sentence of Sartre's autobiography called Les Mots, the words. The last sentence of this autobiography is, "What is left with me? A man made of all men and who's worse, all of them, and..." I'll tell you in English. In French, it's easier. Que reste-t-il? Que reste-t-il? Un homme, c'est lui, Sartre, qui parle. Je suis un homme fait de tous les hommes et qui les vaut tous et que vaut n'importe qui. Basically, Louis, tu traduis? Je suis un homme fait de tous les hommes, made of all other men, et qui les vaut tous and who's worth any other, et que vaut n'importe qui. And whom anybody can...
At anyone's price.
I'm sorry?
At anyone's price?
No.
That anyone is worth
that. Exactly. And that anyone could be worth... Yeah. So basically it's a statement of extreme megalomania and extreme humility. Sartre is the heir of a grand family, a grand tradition. He's the son of Anne-Marie Schweitzer. His mother is a niece of Albert Schweitzer, Nobel Prize of Peace. Nobel Prize of Peace. Dr. Albert Schweitzer, the priest who went to Africa. Sartre is, so he's empowered with this genealogy that he will all together carry over and try to destroy. Sartre is someone who presented himself as a subversive heir. From the age of 20, he started to try and subvert the tradition, the heredity he had. He came from this family of great pedagogues, because the Schweitzer were the origin of the French public teaching in France. But also, and then he went to Ivy League, I mean, the equivalent of the Ivy League, École Normale Supérieure, Agrégation de Philosophie, I mean, in the grand way. But once he was there, at the age of 20, he challenged the authority. At the age of 20, he challenged the director of the École Normale Supérieure, who was called Gustave Lanson, who was not only the director of this Ivy League school, but also the head of French literature studies in the country. Sartre challenged him by writing a play where he would mimic the director and would really try and challenge authority, because he thought that the way things were taught at the time were extremely rigid. He really challenged the rigidity of not only the French system, but also the hierarchy between disciplines. Sartre was fascinated by philosophy and literature, but he was also fascinated by what he called the culture of the present. He was fascinated by cinema, he was fascinated by jazz music, he was fascinated by cartoons. But at that time in France, when he was 20 years old, which is in 1925, those disciplines were not considered as legitimized by the French academic system. They were considered as garbage. They were considered as non-serious disciplines. Whereas cinema, jazz, and cartoons were not worse academic research. But Sartre, as a 20-year-old, were, you know, looking around, trying to figure out what was exciting for people his age. And basically, he tried to bring that into the circle of the academia, those disciplines. It's like as if today you would be deciding to lecture on rap music. Or, you know, like the culture of the margins. So what he did at the age of 20, he wrote a whole thesis on cinema at the École Normale Supérieure that nobody was asking him to do. Or he also went looking outside of French culture. He went grabbing, you know, music from the United States, jazz music. He went grabbing a philosopher from Germany, Husserl and Heidegger. That attitude was not at all considered appropriate in the France of the 1920s and 1930s. He was basically, as a 20-year-old young genius, because that's how everybody described him. I interviewed everybody from his own class. He would really cross borders in all respects. He was crossed borders of disciplines and crossed the borders of national cultures. He would look elsewhere, and with that, he would organize first of all, concepts, notions, theories, attitude. So, what is fascinating when you see him now at the age of 60 here, you see him answering these two journalists, but you also see him answering the question about the Nobel Prize. So Sartre at the age of 20 challenges the director of the school. Sartre at the age of 40 maybe at the age of 50 challenges the head of state, which is General de Gaulle, 1960. In 1960, Sartre is responsible for awakening people about the Algerian Revolution and the Algerian War and the decolonization of Algeria. And he will criticize the French state for torture in Algeria. And so he would say, he would build up a group of people saying, I would have supported the Algerian Revolution. If I had to do it, I would have done it. So basically, he challenged the authority of the president of France, General de Gaulle, and in transgressing the order and saying, I would have committed something illegal if I had to do it. So that's what he was talking about. That was called l'appel des 121, 121 signatures to challenge the French state on this issue. But later on, Sartre gets the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1964 and refuses it. So that's also one thing which is mentioned here. Why did you refuse the Nobel Prize for Literature? Would you have accepted it if you had been given the Nobel Prize for Peace? And he answers, I don't know if you got that, he said, no, I won't have accepted it either, but I would have accepted it if it had been given to me in 1960 rather than 1964 for this signature of people against the French state about the Algerian War. So basically, he would have accepted this honor from Stockholm if it had been about this challenge of the French government in this situation. So, why did I want to show you a little bit of this interview? Just to have a little feeling of the voice, of the attitude, of the way Sartre expresses himself, which is in fact something that I think is really has somewhat disappeared today. But now let's go back to what I wanted to talk to you about, which is the relationship between France and the United States throughout Sartre. Sartre is somebody that has been accused of being the one of the epitome of the enemy of the United States, the French intellectual who's been accused of being an enemy of the United States. Why? Because he criticized the politics of the United States during two very important moments. One, the McCarthy era, 1952, about the Rosenberg trial. And second, in 1967, about the Vietnam War, where he accused the government of the United States to decimate the Vietnamese population. And he became then the president of a tribunal, something which had never existed before, the Russell Tribunal, together with Bertrand Russell, the British philosopher, where he was. Bertrand Russell and Sartre empowered themselves for this position where they play the role of a universal consciousness. Now, those are the two instances where Sartre criticized the United States. And definitely he criticized the country on two very foreign policies issues. Now, for the rest, I must say that Sartre is someone whose career has developed, as I said before, by transgressing the natural borders of his class and of his education, and especially in criticizing in French culture what he found the most archaic, the most static, the most rigid. I mentioned earlier that he found the education in France in the 30s too stiff, too closed, not enough interested by the culture of the present. For him, everything which came from the United States of America was equivalent of modernity. So as a young boy, he would read cartoons like Texas Jack, Sitting Bull, Buffalo Bill. They were the way where he basically invented his passion for, adventures. He said later on, my life was to be a series of adventures, or rather one adventure. That was how I saw it. The adventure took place more or less everywhere, but rarely in Paris. Because in Paris, you don't often see a red skin leap out. So the need for adventures made me conceive of them in America, Africa, or Asia. Those continents were made for adventure. So I began to dream that I would go to America, where I would fight with roughnecks and come out of it safely, having knocked around a fair number of them. So basically, that's how he pictured his life, a series of adventures and adventures in America. Later on, he will be the first one to discover the great American writers from the 30s. John Dos Passos, William Faulkner, Ernest Hemingway, Herman Melville. But not only discover them, translate them and present them. Basically opening the French public to those writers and showing how Dos Passos, Faulkner and Hemingway were revolutionizing the art of fiction and how we needed them in France. So much so that William Faulkner, who can be very often, whom I do compare with Sartre in a lot of issues, William Faulkner, who had a hard time in his own country here, said, when I read what Sartre wrote about me and what Sartre did for me in France, I felt better in my own country. As you know, Faulkner is also someone coming out of a family of a rich family of Mississippi, who himself decided to reconsider the way his family had behaved, and wrote these incredible novels where he challenges the status of the African Americans in the southern states of the United States. So the fact that Sartre adored Faulkner or recognized Faulkner doesn't come by accident. This is another element that American cartoons, American literature, American music. Sartre writes his first novel, Nausea, which is published in 1938, and which is the first philosophical novel, existentialist novel, where the hero finds himself completely at odds with the French provincial context and manages to reinvent his own reality through the music he hears in a bar, which is, some of these days, a piece of music which comes from the United States. It's a blues. And that will completely, reorganize his perception of reality. So the organization of Sartre's writings, of his thinkings, of his evolution, cannot be organized without this temptation to pull out from the United States culture what he imagines as the country of modernity. He would write, when we were 20 years old, in 1925, we thought of the United States as the country of the future. The skyscrapers were the architecture of the future, jazz were the music of the future, the novels were the media of the future, that's where we wanted to go. So for this intellectual born in Paris, surrounded by books from this elitist École Normale Supérieure, the United States of America carried an incredible wealth of elements which would help him decipher his own culture, challenge his own culture, and enrich his own culture. Now, that's the passion. In 1945, Albert Camus arrives and tells Sartre that there's an invitation to spend 6 months in the United States on behalf of a newspaper called Figaro, Le Figaro, and another one called Combat. And he wonders whether Sartre is interested, and Sartre says, I'm going. Immediately he jumps on the plane, and for 6 months he's going to explore the country, even come to Albany, Ithaca, and discover the country of his dreams. What happens there is extremely interesting, because Sartre, at the contact of the United States, Sartre is not only switching from the point of view of a professor, a reader, a writer, somebody really entrenched from reality, to the status of a fieldwork journalist who's confronted with a reality and the reality of a foreign country. And he is going to write a lot through his travels. And these texts, which are very numerous and have not been published yet, is one of the projects that I have to really bring out those incredible texts about. There's texts about Hollywood. He sees for the first time this film by Orson Welles. What is it? Rosebud. Citizen Kane. Thank you so much, Citizen Kane. He sees it from Hollywood. He goes. I mean, it's really a fascinating panorama. More important is that these texts about the United States show a very deep empathy between Sartre and the country. It is the portrait of a country in time of war. It is also the travel journal of an ethnographer. It's also a philosophical essay on something that Sartre calls Americanism. And in many respects, it's maybe the best travel diary through the United States after Tocqueville. Sartre wanted to make a book out of it. He wanted to call it Tableautin d'Amérique, Little Portraits of America. He never did it because his friend, his girlfriend, the woman he lived with, Simone de Beauvoir, did her own book on the United States called L'Amérique au jour le jour, America Day by Day, which happens to be a terrible book, extremely poor. I just lectured on that recently at New York University for the Simone de Beauvoir Centennial. She wrote two books at the same time. Between 1947 and 1951, she started two different books. One is the book on the United States, which is, I mean, the worst. I mean, a bunch of gossips, basically, she says people in Santa Fe look like people in Saint-Tropez. I mean, unbelievable. But this is Simone de Beauvoir. But while she was writing this horrible book, in fact, stealing the books that Sartre had to write about the United States, she was also starting another book, The Second Sex, which happened to be the Bible of feminism in the 20th century. So, but that's for next time, okay? Or next year, or whatever. It's Simone de Beauvoir's own trajectory. As for Sartre, what you see in his text on American democracy shows this empathy I was talking about. Let me just quote something. The American considers his thought as universal. This might be a sign of the influence of Puritanism. Something else. He says, one should not see... Oh, yeah. He says... he talks about the function of money in the United States. He says, one should not see it as greed or simply a test for luxury. Money in the United States, I would say, is merely the necessary but symbolic sign of success. One has to succeed because success proves the moral virtues of intelligence and also because it shows that one enjoys divine protection. So, you can see here through this text, through this description of the meaning of money in the United States, somewhere the Max Weber, the ethic of Protestantism and the spirit of capitalism. And Sartre would also talk about education values in America, philanthropy in the United States. And one thing I have been able to decipher is that the way Sartre would read American values, he would read it through the prism, through the lenses, through the glasses of his own Protestant education. In this interview, another time in this interview, he would say, by accident, Sartre said, Luther said, each man is a prophet. You know, just like that, you know, even without even thinking, you know. So Sartre thinking is completely mingled with his Protestant ethic. And that's not surprising because he was raised by his grandfather Schweitzer. He was homeschooled till the age of 12. And the grandfather was the one who created this method of teaching languages through context, the actually German language. So when the little boy arrived at school, he was really like a bore because he was self-taught and taught by this incredible pedagogue who was like 70 years older than him. And but nevertheless, that made him react to the virtues of American democracy like nobody else. And so he would come back and lecture about the United States in France and write about the United States in France. But another thing Sartre discovers from these trips is, for the first time, racial discrimination. And in the southern states, in the United States, at the time, he noticed that, you know, in the train, you had segregation in the train, segregation in the schools. So he reacted to that, saying in this wonderful country, in this wonderful democratic country, there are still these millions of people who have no rights. And that would be the awakening of his career as an ethical militant. So basically, it's by looking at a country which is far away from his own, by looking at, by discovering racial segregation far away from his own home, that he will become his career of ethical militant. So both the United States helped Sartre furbish his own tools as a modernist inventor, creator, philosopher, writer, playwright, critic, but also they made him aware of racial discrimination. When Sartre comes back to France after these first two trips, that's when he's going to stand up and challenge two things. First, the fact that in France during the World War II, when the Germans were occupying France, there was this the attitude of the French population against the Jews. I mean, the Germans, of course, but also some French police. So Sartre wrote a book called Réflexion sur la question juive, 1946, which is translated Antisemite and the Jew in the United States, and where he says, who is a collaborator? Who are these French people who collaborated with the Germans? So basically, instead of accepting this, you know, wonderful attitude of that's it, we finished, we all love each other and so on, he said, no, let's look under the rug, you know, let's address this taboo, you know. There was collaboration in France, let's try to understand why such a thing existed. Mm-hmm. He did the same thing, this attitude of trying to address taboos, he did the same thing. In 1947, he wrote a book called, actually it was the introduction, it's called Black Orpheus, the introduction for poetry from the West Indies and from Africa, where he introduced poets like Aimé Césaire, the poet from Martinique, who passed away last June at the age of 96, who was the mayor of the city of Fort-de-France, and he introduced another wonderful, wonderful writer called Léopold Sédar Senghor, who was from Senegal, a Normalien, agrégé de lettres, and president of Senegal. So Sartre introduced their poetry and showed the incredible value of people coming from outside of from the French colonial empire, but whose voices were immensely enriching the French heritage. So at the same time, Sartre wakes up on these two issues, antisemitism and colonialism. But and his own trajectory of evolving from a militant, from discovering racial discrimination in the United States, discovering the voice from the colonized, the support of the Algerian Revolution would take him to attack the American government around the Vietnam War. That's what he said in 1967, when he was the president of the Russell Tribunal. And that, what I want to show here is that Sartre's evolution is extremely consequent. Someone who always coming from the tradition of the French intellectual who challenges his own country, like Voltaire had done for the Affaire Calas in the 18th century, like Zola had done for the Dreyfus case in the 19th century, Sartre did it for all those cases in his own culture and in foreign cultures. So 1967, when he decides that he will not come to Cornell, but he will send his lecture nevertheless, he says that he's not coming because of the Vietnam War. He said the following thing. we cannot come to the aid of American anti-racists. For someone to come from abroad and declare racism is wrong would help absolutely no one. American society has produced his myth and its ideology, and this myth and this ideology in opposition to them will have to form the basis for a new American way of thinking. This cannot come from Europe. Vietnam is a different story. The only way we might be able to contribute to awareness of it is by making an outright, all-encompassing condemnation of American policy in Vietnam, and by trying to provoke, wherever possible, that is in Europe, protests against that policy. It is not only Vietnam that is at stake. There would be repercussions throughout the whole Third World and in Latin America. Another quote at the same time, which I wanted to address to you and ask you whether you thought it can be it could be relevant today in a time of the Iraqi war that not many people hear about. Recently, during the presidential election, nobody seems to be knowing what is happening there. Nevertheless, a lot of money has gone into it and a lot of mess. I want to ask you whether you think that's relevant. That's what Sartre said in 1967, the reason why he was not coming to Cornell. I wish to say also that we do not have to regard the United States as the center of the world. Granted, it is the greatest power in the world, but it is far from being the center. As Europeans, we even have the duty not to consider America as the center of the world. We must show solidarity and interest in the people from all over the world and with all our friends who have worked their way towards the threshold of survival and freedom, and who can prove each day that the greatest power in the world is incapable of imposing its laws, that it is also the most vulnerable power in the world, and that the world has not chosen it to be its center of gravity. The United States will evolve, of course, slowly, very slowly, and better, I think, if one resists it that if one preaches to it. So, Cecilia, in order to start your French club, I think that these few considerations of Sartre, the French philosopher of the 20th century, might challenge a little things in this context of presidential election today in the United States. That's how I would stop my speech and take the questions. Thank you.
Up for discussion if any of you have any questions. I know that anyone would be more than willing to answer any of them. And we'd also like to thank you so much for coming. And please join us for the reception after.
Luis.
I
know you're going to criticize me. I knew that.
I was just wondering.
I'm ready.
Because this question of the French concept of the philosopher and the engaged intellectual.
Committed.
A committed mm-hmm. intellectual.
Mm-hmm. Se mêler de ce qui ne le regarde pas.
Yes, se mêler de ce qui ne le regarde pas, mm-hmm. and that have such a public stance and yeah. a public, mm-hmm. You know, being the conscience morale of their mm-hmm. time. Mm-hmm. Does it exist today? And why does it seem that there's not such a presence, and that there's no more Jean Balzac and no more Voltaire today to actually be the ones mm-hmm. asking the questions mm-hmm. on behalf of humanity mm-hmm. to the leaders of our
Sir,
world.
Sir, before you go, you had a question. No, the question is gone. Okay, so, I mean, what do you think?
In France or in the United States?
Yeah.
In the world, today, there's not a...
So, yeah, what do you think yourself? What do you think? You think that it's not relevant?
I mean, I see like Bernard Lévy yeah. and I see all that, but is that, is that...
Let me laugh a little bit.
Of today, or...
You had a question, sir, before leaving, because... Yeah, I mean, I'm going to take a few questions and then maybe I'll answer.
My comment follows very, and first of all, thank you very much for coming. Thank you especially for coming to speak to the students. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful. Mm-hmm. But my question is in part a response to Louis and in part a question. When you told the story about the 27-year-old Ivy Leaguer,
yeah.
you didn't say which college he came from. I hope it wasn't Cornell. Anyway, when you told that story, I asked myself, is it a question of Ivy Leaguers not knowing about Sartre, a French philosopher, or is it a question about Ivy Leaguers not knowing about philosophers? And then I asked a further question, would the equivalent Ivy Leaguer, quote-unquote, grandes écoles graduate in France be any more cultured about philosophers from other countries than the Ivy Leaguer was about Sartre? And I had to put forward a very pessimistic hypothesis, and that is the young people I meet in France today are no more cosmopolitan than the young people you're meeting in America today. And I believe it doesn't have to do with either the decline of French civilization or the decline of American civilization. I think it has to do with something we might call over-specialization. That is, there are many young people who are extremely well-trained, both in France and the United States, in their disciplines, but who are utterly ignorant outside of those disciplines. And I think that is not their fault, because that's the way we tend to structure higher education today. We tend to structure it as gaining training in a specialization rather than gaining culture.
In France, philosophy is part of every single back exam. Philosophy is a required subject to pass the baccalaureate. Whether you take the scientific route, the economic route, or the literary route, it's required. I don't think that's true in the high school. I don't think it's required. I think also that Sartre is not, I
won't see Sartre as a philosopher, I would see him as an intellectual. I mean, if somebody didn't know his philosophy, that wouldn't be that important for me. But if somebody doesn't know that he was a consciousness, a moral consciousness, a committed intellectual, that's more important for me. But we can talk about that. That's extremely interesting. I'm fascinated by the topic. Fascinated, and I mean, with French Club, Cecilia, you're not going to do confrontation between what is better here, is it better there, you know. I think that's not the way to go. I have never gone that way. I've never said, you know, in France, I mean, in America, they don't know about Sartre, but do the French know about Noam Chomsky, for example? I don't think, do they?
Most certainly.
No, they sell us books in the airport, and they used to. They sell books of Pierre Bourdieu and stuff like that. They'd say that Pierre Bourdieu in Fnac, they would have a, you know, sort of like Noam Chomsky would be the Pierre Bourdieu American, and the in reverse. So it would be that they would make that kind of comparison. They would say that one was the Pierre Bourdieu American, the other was the,
So we discussed that, the way the intellectual life is organized within society in France and Western society.
I would like to join my colleague in congratulating you for your enthusiasm and your willingness to share it with students. Though I obviously disagree with you on many points. For instance, I would contend that what Voltaire was for Calas and for Dreyfus, Sartre was for de Rosenberg. The big difference is that Calas was innocent. Rosenberg were actual Soviet spies, but that's really a little tale. My two short questions. First, you mentioned only briefly the fact that Sartre was invited to Cornell to deliver a lecture on commencement day. I believe it was in 1965. And Rodney was okay until Sartre sent a telegram to Cornell president only, I believe, 2 weeks before commencement day, saying that he wouldn't eventually show up because of the American war crimes in Vietnam, which was not only in that form, that doesn't matter, but also raises important questions. And is it fair not to make a difference between the American administration and the American people, after all, especially on this campus, on this very liberal campus, many people, many students, many professors were against the war in Vietnam. Sure. How would you, you're not Sartre's lawyer or anything?
No,
isn't there a problem here?
Yeah.
And my second question goes back to this interview, and especially at the moment when Sartre says that we should break with this division of labor, and that writers should actually become non-specialists, people who are able to deal with many issues, to do several jobs, and isn't that also problematic at a time when writers were denied the right to exist as writers, not in the United States, but especially in the communist yeah, countries?
Sure. Okay, yeah, now, I'm going to answer all things, but I'm going to answer on two little things. First of all, when I compared Sartre to Voltaire, the Affaire Calas, and Zola, the Affaire Dreyfus, it was the Sartre in French society, the Sartre who raised up about, who raised...
And De Gaulle made the comparison before.
Yeah, exactly. No, but it was about anti-Semitism and the Jew, the collaboration, I mean, only French issues, okay? I mean, issues of his own nation. Second thing about he's not coming to Cornell, I think it's absolutely stupid. I think it's ridiculous that he didn't come to Cornell. A lot of people, you're absolutely right. I mean, and in my books, there's a lot of distance with Sartre. I mean, my own power towards him is that I have criticized him a lot. And I think that I criticize him about his text on Cuba in 1960, I criticize him about his text from the United States in 1954. You know, I mean, there's a lot of places where I totally feel totally free to say, here you're completely wrong. And the little interview here, where it is about this travail, division of labor, is a Sartre in total utopia, you know. I completely agree with you. Sartre is sometimes somebody very problematic, but for me, the whole of his trajectory and his example is beyond that. And I will discuss that later. But I just wanted to answer these two points before.
Mm-hmm. I have a question that's also about cross-cultural exchange. Uh-huh. And here, there was a name that you didn't mention, that there were so many that Sartre was important in bringing over, but one, of course, is Richard Wright, mm-hmm. and Native mm-hmm. Son sure, was sure, an sure, important sure. one. Mm-hmm. And I bring this up because I guess I have a somewhat different appreciation of de Beauvoir's mm-hmm. and Amélie Jules Le Jour, and that I do think it's an uneven work. But I think one of the benefits, I think, for students reading it in America mm-hmm. is the depiction of Jim Crow segregation that she gives, and especially the passages on Gunnar Myrdal, because mm-hmm. Richard Wright was in many ways her tour guide to the United States. Mm-hmm. So the Wrights were very important in that way, and highlighting miscegenation, laws that still were not overturned, you know, until some decades later. And so many there are people who have written, such as Peg Margaret Simons and other people, saying that it's actually the model of racial oppression that she gets from the United States through Gunnar Myrdal mm-hmm. that Wright gives her that comes back in The Second Sex. Yeah. The Second Sex isn't so much existentialism as it's racial oppression, and then that comes back to America and our notions of sort of feminism through The Second Sex. Yeah. So that in a certain way then, and I think Jules Le Jour becomes a more important
work. Yeah, it's a very specific, I know very well this argument. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an argument. To make a long
but even if, but even if you don't agree with what does, but this
but Simone de Beauvoir gets she uses two or three books.
She spends a long time on Myrdal.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. But I mean, she basically she's being helped by you know she quotes him. Mm-hmm. It's true that she compares the racial issue with gender issues. I mean, she would talk about
But she's not so much doing that there. There she's really talking about race.
In the second sex. So it's a very
But it's interesting how the exchange works.
It is. It is
person of
right. You're right. You're right. It's more than that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Other questions? I think Cecilia, you had something.
I was interested in your comment about Sartre's background as Protestant mm-hmm. and his education. Mm-hmm. I'd read the Mode, Les Mode, mm-hmm. years ago, mm-hmm. and I remember putting it down and thinking he hates everything about his background. He doesn't like the fact that he's a writer. He's not. He thinks it's a sort of a joke. I'm a man only made of words, mm-hmm. a sort of paper mache person. How does that figure into what he did in that book? I mean, how does his strength of, you said he derived a great deal of strength or character from his homeschooling and Protestant background. Is he positive about all of that, or is he negative?
No, he's not positive at all. I mean, he's Sartre was crazy. Sartre was nuts. He's a man who really...
A man of many parts, we say, not crazy.
No, but I mean, he engendered himself at the age of 8 years old. At the age of 8 years old, he was himself his own janitor, and he became a writer by his own decision. I mean, it's Les Mots tells it clearly. Sartre has an incredible orgueil, pride, incredible, and he would think that through the words you just, you know, become immortality. But it was a way for him to avoid being the object in the hands of his great grandfather. So I mean it's a complex thing, but it's true that Sartre has no sympathy, no nostalgia for roots, for past, for aridity. Sartre is someone who's immediately geared towards the future, towards the new, toward the other side, toward the other one, towards the ailleurs, elsewhere. That's what his notion of adventure. Now let me answer the answers. So about, is there any relevance of being a committed intellectual today? Why cannot we see committed intellectuals here or there? Why is there nobody that stands up to challenge, you know, such and such political issue, such and such moral issue? Or are they some people? You evoked with a smile my dear friend Bernard Lévy, who was my first publisher, and who compares himself to Sartre in a ridiculous way, in a totally ridiculous way. Bernard Lévy is driven by a personal driver with a Mercedes who drives on the Boulevard Saint-Germain against the law. And is, I mean, you know, Bernard Lévy is an awfully rich man, extremely rich, extremely opulent, extremely superficial. He thought he understood something of the United States, and he did this book, which is a bunch of superficialities, and he's been destroyed in the New York Times by, what's the name of this guy who wrote on the man from Minnesota?
Garrison Keillor.
Yes, yeah. Garrison Keillor piece was the best. I couldn't have devoted more to that. So basically, Bernard Lévy is in, you know, the tradition of the superficial French essayist who thinks that, you know, going two or three places you can, with kind of beautiful period oratoire, you have understood everything. I mean, this is not at all the Sartre way, I mean, you know. And Lévy is someone who, you know, is trying to, Sartre was working hard. I mean, Lévy doesn't work, you know, he's somebody who tries to compensate, like, you know, Michel Foucault. Once Michel Foucault was accused, Jacques Attali was accused of stealing from Michel Foucault, and Michel Foucault said, people ask him, do you think that Jacques Attali stole from you? And Michel Foucault said, the only thing I can tell you is that in order to do research, you have to make your hands dirty. Pour faire de la recherche, il faut se salir les mains. Okay? So Sartre is somebody who worked. Foucault is somebody who worked. Lévy and Attali are people who do not work. They just, you know, I mean, publish books and love the you know, the fancy of mediatic appearances and so on. But I mean, they are, I mean, and you know, they've been criticized by experts, and you know, we don't. So, okay, so let's look for some other people. When Sartre passed away in 1980, it was extremely interesting to see how in the French press people tried to analyze his passing away. There were three attitudes. People would say, let's look for the 10 worst mistakes that Sartre ever made politically. So, was it United States? Was it when he went to the USSR? Was it Cuba? Was it? So people tried to accuse him of all the mistakes, of political mistakes of the past years. Second thing, people would try to find him, to find for him a successor. After Saab, who was the name of an article by Le Matin de Paris? Who would be after Saab? So they had a list. Jacques Derrida, Michel Foucault, Jacques Attali, Bernard-Henri Lévy, Claude Lévi-Strauss, Roland Barthes, you know?
All French.
All French. Excuse me. I mean, you don't want Chomsky in France, it was French. French story for French people.
Yeah, but Sartre was international, you were saying.
Yeah, this is true. This is true. But anyway, that was a French paper. And my position on that is that what made Sartre raise as a consciousness and right or wrong was a combination of many elements. It was a combination of the search of an individual with his past, his future, and the combination of the context, the political, historical context. He was not involved during the 30s, but he raised as an intellectual engagé in 1945 when he created his magazine Les Temps Modernes, at a time where, after the tabula rasa of the World War II, he was looking for a meaning in French society. And also, he was looking for a meaning for French culture in the world. What has become, what has happened to us? What happened to French culture? We have been challenged. We've been challenged during these two world wars, taking place in less than 20 years. What has happened to Europe? Why has Europe destroyed itself? What is going to happen to us towards the rise of American movies, American culture, American, you know. So these are the questions that Sartre asked himself, his own country, and the people around him. That's because he was pioneer. He saw things, he anticipated, he felt the little, you know, movements of society. He understood when he gave this lecture in 1945 called L'Existentialisme et un Humanisme, he really described himself as the intellectual of 1945 from France, and what did he have to do with the other one, the African, the American, the Asian? You know, he was really the one who perceived that the French, the impact of French culture had been challenged. And he's the one who understood very early on that the French colonial empire had, you know, had to organize itself differently. That's why he, you know, he perceived the voices from the West Indies, from Africa, from. So he's someone who very early on understood that this relationship between the hegemony of French culture was at stake. And I mean, what I usually say when, you know, I'm being asked whether I endorse all Sartre's statements, I say absolutely not. But what he did is that he looked, he searched. He didn't take anything for granted. You know, he fell down, he woke up, he stood up, he tried, he contradicted himself, he tried hard and he was authentic. I mean, there's not one instance where I can say that Sartre was not authentic. So he did that on behalf of his own values, which were, I mean, the best of the American democratic values. So why no intellectual has stood up recently? In the United States, in Europe, do we find any books? Do we find any articles? Do we find? I agree that do we need one? You know, when Sartre passed away, there was someone who said, now that Sartre has died, when something very important happens in the world, we won't be able to say, but in fact, what does Sartre think about it? You know, that's the way it was. I mean, Sartre became what I call, and even when he was wrong, you know, but he was challenging, I call that ethical compass. Sartre's role evolved as an ethical compass. You don't remember, you were too young, but I mean, I remember for myself, I mean, it is true that he would stand up and say something and at the right moment, or point out the right question, even if he didn't arrive at the right answer. You know, it was not about the right answer, it was about the right question. That's what Sartre was all about, you know? It's asking the right questions. So, about the guy from University of Pennsylvania who never heard the name of Sartre, and you spoke about over-specialization, France versus the United States. I would tend to think that when you look at the way education is organized in France and the US, in the two countries, one thing which is clear is that a country where foreign languages are not being taught enough, where geography is not being taught enough, mainly where the reality of the other one is not being taught enough, is more the United States than France. You know, in France, it's very, very common that people learn at school 3 to 4 to 5 languages, and Louis and Cecilia are among them. You know, I mean, you never see in the United States somebody 20 years old who speaks 6 languages. You know,
I can't not answer.
Okay, you do answer.
I can't not answer. First of all, I agree with you completely.
Yeah.
We are the most provincial imperial power probably in the history of the world. You know, the British, when they went out to India, some of them at least learned Hindu. We don't even bother. We just expect it. So I'm agreeing with you on that. However, the tendency for the French beyond the intellectual elite to learn foreign languages and to speak them comfortably is a very recent phenomenon. It's a very recent phenomenon that an American who goes to Paris will comfortably find that he or she can speak English with people who speak English quite well. When I started doing research in France, most of my colleagues who were political scientists, who were distinguished political scientists, could not speak English, and they seldom read.
Oh, you're right. No, this is...
So this is a relatively new phenomenon, and so it's hard for me to connect it to this cosmopolitanism. The cosmopolitanism of the age of Sartre was a much broader cosmopolitan.
You're right. No, you're right.
You see?
That's part of the Cold War.
No.
We're celebrating what Sartre did, his accomplishments here. We've become pluralistic.
I want even to give you more elements. When I was at the French Embassy, we would organize meetings with American historians who were working on France, and we had a bunch of 3,000 people. We had wonderful people. It is thanks to American historians that we've been able to analyze some traumas of our society. Robert Paxton, Michael Maris, Eugene Weber, all of them, they are extremely important to us, and these are issues that the French cannot address. On the other side, when we try to find French historians working in the United States, we have two. And I am extremely aware of it. Not only am I aware of it, but I have fought for it and I failed. I'm going to explain to you why. I noticed that when I was at the embassy that, you know, the French, not only in the academia but in diplomatic circles, they don't know how to deal with North-North. The French can do North-South. The French have a history of a colonial empire. They know how to deal with their previous colonies. They don't know how to deal with their peers. There's no tradition. Americanists don't exist in the French academia, and I myself was elected a tenure professor, rang A, in the University of Caen, to do American studies. There had been no professor of American studies for 10 years in this university, but then when I arrived there, I was absolutely impeached. I was incapable of doing my job because there was a lobby of the Irish scholars, and I could not develop my American studies there. Now, the point is, when you go through the American presidential election, I mean, it goes from the academia to the journalism. Basically, it's a kind of vicious circle. When you need to understand American presidential election, you need to have people in the media speak about the United States, and you have just a handful of people. You have, and that comes from the academia, because it's the from the academia that. And I remember, I went to the Ministry of Education saying, you know, you have to create more Americanists in France. You have to develop American studies in France. America is neither the best nor the worst. You have to look at the United States culture in a kind of very peaceful way. You know, how, you know, we have to look at the tendency has been in France either to ban the United States, like Régis Debray, people like that, you know, in Le Monde Diplomatique, there's a long tradition of banishing the US and everything, or to embellish it, you know. Ce n'est ni aussi pire ni aussi merveilleux, c'est beaucoup plus réel. I mean, French-American studies have to be handled in a much more realistic way. You know, people have to do field work, people have to... But I mean, now things are changing. There are like people working on American religion. I mean, we have like now 10 to 20 great academics, you know, working on... you know, American social issues, American religion, American urban questions, American sociology. But you are right. The absence of fluency towards English language and especially about American studies in France has been a problem. I mean, definitely. So, but you know, I mean, I mean, we should not be, you know, doing a match, you know, it's not, you know, like confronting two cultures and what is it. I mean, the only way we have to deal with the intercultural issues is complementary behavior. And I think that's what is the most challenging here. To answer about, yeah, the invitation of Sartre Cornell. Yeah, I think I did answer you. I mean, I am a critic of Sartre. I mean, I'm really an open critic of Sartre. I mean, as I said, you know, I am challenged by his attitude. I am critical of his some of his positions. But all in all, I think that he just indicated that the questions. And the answer is yourself. I mean, he empowered the other one. Sartre is the one who said, you know, each teacher has to be challenged. You know, a good teacher is someone who has to be challenged. Nobody has to get, you know, from his position, the opinion that he cannot be challenged. I mean, so that's what I remember from him. So any other question we can answer next door, or good luck for your French class, Cecilia, and congratulations.